Martin and Grace, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for listening. I'll be at Jessup University later tonight with Michael Medved and Dennis Prager as we continue our 100 days of Obama tour across the United States. I'm pleased to begin this hour. We're broadcasting from Jessup University today with Michael Rubin. He's a resident scholar at American Enterprise Institute. Michael, welcome back to the program. It's great to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, I want to start in Pakistan. You wrote a piece. It's posted over at AEI's website on the peril 60 miles from the capital. I don't think many Americans really understand that Pakistan and or Turkey may become Obama's Iran, as Carter was had his Iran. How significant is the peril to the state of Pakistan right now?
The peril is very significant. The issue isn't whether the Taliban, which moved in this region that's just 60 miles away from Islamabad, Pakistan's capital, will continue to the capital. The terrain is against that. They'd be moving from a mountainous area to the plains where the 700,000-man Pakistani army is. The problem is, and this is what I was taking the Obama administration to task on, is that they seem blind to two things. Number one is blind to the problem of Islamist ideology, and number two is blind to the danger of creating a safe haven or allowing a safe haven in which the Taliban could operate. When this march happened from the Taliban to this neighboring district, Hillary Clinton gave a comment saying, "This just shows that the Pakistani government has to focus more on its economy so that such things won't happen." But the problem is, it's not happening because of the economy. It's happening because the Taliban are bent on overthrowing the Pakistani government and gaining control of the Pakistani government's nuclear weapons.
Michael Rubin, do they have a strategy? Does the Taliban actually have a strategy that could lead to the dissolution of the Pakistani government and the installation of an Islamist government?
Indeed they do. David Gardenstein-Ross, who's an analyst over at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, has written, looking at the debate within al-Qaeda, about different strategies in which they can expand their strength, overthrow governments, and so forth. Now, one Islamist ideologue, Abu Naji, has written extensively, and this is the guy who the Taliban in Pakistan are listening to, about the need to create safe havens. This is the same problem we had in Afghanistan before 9/11, when al-Qaeda created a safe haven, or we also have now in Somalia, where al-Qaeda is creating a safe haven. What they are saying is the first step is to create a safe haven, and then after that, we can consolidate our forces. What happened in Pakistan back in February was there was something called the Malakand Accords, which gave the Taliban group a safe haven, and in the course of 2 months, they more than doubled the number of their forces in the Swat Valley. And then once 2 months were up, they marched on this neighboring district. What the Obama administration needs to learn is while it looks at diplomacy as a way to reach compromise and therefore seems to bless some of these deals which create safe havens, it's really the safe haven which is what al-Qaeda is after, and we should deny it to them.
Michael Rubin, in the New York Times today, there's an article, an extensive debrief over many months of a senior Taliban strategist who says the only thing that really bothers them are the Predator drone strikes. Is the Swat Valley off-limit to our Predators?
I'm not aware that it is or isn't. What we've been doing with the Predator drone strike is are going after certain districts in Bajor and so forth. I would hope that the Obama administration will continue to use the Predator strikes in this region. Simply put, I don't know whether they have or not.
I want to switch to Iran. I also want to switch to Joe Biden. Here is a clip of Joe Biden today talking at AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee.
You're not going to like my saying this, but not build more settlements, dismantle existing outposts, and allow the Palestinians freedom of movement based on their first actions, access to economic opportunity, and increased security responsibility. This is a show-me deal. Not based on faith, show-me.
What do you make of such a demand on Israel, Michael Rubin?
I find it really ignorant. Now, look, back, I believe it was in 2005 or 2006, Israel unilaterally withdrew from the Gaza Strip. Terrorism didn't decline. It increased. you've had several thousand rockets fall on Israel, and we've now seen that Iranians try to supply more rockets into Gaza. On top of that, when Israel withdrew, they left behind the greenhouses, the economic infrastructure, and the first thing which the Palestinians did was to destroy that. Now, what Joe Biden has to realize, and again, this goes to what I was criticizing before with Hillary Clinton's blind spot, is that there is Islamist ideology out there, and Israel recognizes more than Joe Biden that Hamas, which now controls the Gaza Strip, maintains a genocidal ideology. And we've got to face that first and foremost. The problem is not Israel occupying parts of the West Bank right now. The problem is that many of these groups believe that if they have a safe haven, they can move forward with plans of terrorism. And what the Obama and Biden administration don't have is any answer to deal with that inconvenient fact. We don't want to get into a situation where we are pressuring Israel, where we are pressuring the Republic of Georgia, where we are pressuring Taiwan to make concessions, unilateral concessions in the face of terrorism. Because also what Joe Biden most certainly doesn't understand is that this isn't just about Israel. Every single country is looking at how we treat our allies and how we treat our adversaries. And if Joe Biden decides to make Israel make unilateral concessions to Hamas, then we can expect North Korea to demand unilateral concessions from South Korea, China to demand such things from Taiwan, and we're going to be down a very slippery yet dangerous slope indeed.
I'm speaking with Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, about matters of national security. I'm going to talk politics with Michael Barone after the break, so stay tuned. Now, Michael Rubin, on Friday I spent 2 hours with Amir Tahiri about his book, The Persian Night. His opinion is, democracy in Iran is a fool's game. Don't pay attention to elections. They're as managed as they are in the Soviet Union. A competing narrative is that if Ahmadinejad is beaten in June, that this will represent a huge and significant shift inside of Iran. And today there are a couple of articles saying that the Supreme Leader may have issued a signal to people that Ahmadinejad is no longer. I mean, we're trying to read tea leaves. Who is right, Tahiri or those who put hope in Iranian elections?
In this case, Tahiri is right, and the reason is, under the constitution of the Islamic Republic and under the system implemented by Ayatollah Khomeini, who led the Islamic Revolution in 1979, sovereignty rests not with the people, but with God. The people are secondary to that, and therefore the leadership of Iran doesn't care what elections show, because most decisions they are going to say that they are channeling from a higher cause. Now, the whole reason why Iran maintains the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is to defend the leadership against the people. Now, putting that aside, we already know who the major candidates are in next month's elections. On one hand, we have Ahmadinejad. On the other hand, we have Mohsen Rezai, the former head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who was at the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps when the Marine Barracks, for example, in Beirut were blown up, when the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires was blown up. Mohsen Rezai's own son told the United States that his father was responsible for that. On top of which, we have the so-called reformist, a guy named Mir Hussein Mousavi, who was prime minister of Iran during the Iran-Iraq War, and who at his first press conference said that Iran would be committed to its nuclear energy program. So I'm not sure whether we'd have much change. In fact, I think that the most dangerous situation we would have is if the so-called reformists got back into power, because then, I mean, the only difference in the Iranian elections is a difference of style, not substance. But all too often our diplomats are fooled by style. Don't forget, when you look back at that 2007 National Intelligence Estimate that talked about Iran building, working on nuclear weapons until at least 2003. Who was president then, the hardliners or the reformists? It was the reformists.
30 seconds, and, Michael Rubin. How dangerous are the next 3 months vis-a-vis Iran and Israel and the world?
The next 3 months are extremely dangerous. The clock is ticking. Most analysts believe the clock is ticking. One of the key factors which is going to determine whether the Israelis strike or not is whether the Russians ship sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles to Iran. we look at Iran as strategically untenable. That's our problem with this nuclear program. Israel looks at it as an existential threat, and if they see their existence on the line, they're not really going to care what Joe Biden says.
Michael Rubin from AEI, always provocative, always informative. We have to have you back more often in these next crucial months.